you know, I can travel anywhere when I'm in a bath. I go into my own little world. But the tap of the bath was broken, so it's going like.
You're listening to Melody AM, the Nordic Music Podcast, with me, Daron Davidson. And I'm really happy that you're tuning in for this, the first episode of Season 2. My wonderful co-presenter, Chris Lilly, and I had taken a few months' pause to plan and prepare this new season, as well as to renovate our website. And during this period, some exciting life and work things have been keeping Chris out of mischief. Well, I hope in some mischief as well. So although I'm now starting this season 2 trip on my own, I'm hopeful that Chris will be joining me on some of the pit stops along the way. For those of you who are new to Melody AM, this podcast celebrates music and musicians from Iceland, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Finland, and the Faroe Islands, exploring what inspires those artists, as well as finding out about their favourite things or places in their respective corners of the Nordic region. In season 1, we spoke to our favourite Danish pop Viking, Asbjørn, chatted to Jenny Wilson backstage before her Stockholm gig, gossiped with Pure Shores about Melodifestivalen, found out about the Faroe Islands from Janus Rasmussen, had an absolute hoot with Stefan Storm, who most certainly never burnt the famous Christmas goat in Gävle. We discussed socialism, rye bread and socks with Casper from Efterklang. Quizzed I Am Am I Who Am I's Yonna Lee about the time that she performed with the Venger Boys in Japan. We mused about boy band life with Oscar Ernestad and got tips from Kate Havnevik about how you can combine hiking and dating in Norway. We also dedicated an episode to ABBA, featuring an interview with the director of the ABBA Museum in Stockholm. And we had a special pop summit with music journalist extraordinaire Michael Cragg, which was all about Swedish songwriter and producer Max Martin. Do check out those earlier episodes on our website at melodyam.com, where you will also find playlists we've created for the music of each of our guests. And now, on to the first artist interview of the new series, and I'm pleased as punch to tell you that the artist in question is Icelandic singer-songwriter Emiliana Torini. My heart is beating like a jungle. My heart is beating like a jungle drum. My heart is beating like a jungle drum. I've been an avid listener of Emiliana's music for over 2 decades, and the last time we spoke was in 2013. I remember that during our conversation there was suddenly a sort of gasp on the other side of the phone. She had accidentally dropped her lunch on the floor. I mentioned the 10 seconds rule, suggesting that if she picked it up quickly enough, it's as if nothing ever happened. But she was so happy with how delicious the food was that she was comfortable that even if it stayed on the floor for like half an hour, she'd still eat it. Emiliana, who was born in Reykjavik to an Icelandic mother and an Italian father, began her music career in the mid-90s. She contributed vocals to the debut album by Icelandic band Spoon in 1994, and then she went on to release her own debut, a covers album, in 1995. But her first big international album, and essentially her breakthrough, came in 1999 with Love in the Time of Science, an album she released after moving away from Iceland to London. Her latest project, Racing the Storm, sees Emiliana teaming up once again with Belgian musicians Arich Jespers and Corby Proosmans, who jointly go by the name The Colorist Orchestra. Talking about her work with the duo, Emiliana tells me, "It's the circus I always wished to run away with as a kid." And the result is an album where none of the 11 tracks is skippable. And to my ears, it's one of the best things Emiliana has ever released. In this interview, we also talk about Emiliana working with Kylie Minogue as the 20th anniversary of Slow approaches later on this year. We find out why the Icelander takes her baths with a snorkel. And we hear about the time Emiliana made Belle and Sebastian fish for their own supper in a place called Borgarfjörður Eystri. Yes, I had to practice that about 3 times. Emiliana Torini, welcome to Melody AM, and thank you so much for joining me. How are you doing?
Good, thank you for having me.
We last spoke 10 years ago, and it was just before the release of Tuca, where you told me about each of the tracks on that album.
Mm-hmm.
For people hearing about your new album and that it comes 10 years after your last studio album of new materials, that might seem like a, you know, taking your time. And of course, that hasn't been the case at all. You have had another album with the Colorist Orchestra. We have had 3 years of a pandemic. What else has happened in your world in that intervening period?
I've still been working. I've been doing some thing for theatre here in Iceland. Did for the National Theatre for a beautiful, huge one-man piece show. I've been working on another record that comes out next year. And then probably a record that comes the following year. So suddenly it's like boing. I've had a baby in the meantime. She's 5 now. And then I'm on an island where you're quite isolated. It's very different to live somewhere, you know, that's not in a mainland Europe. Like, you know, you guys probably don't know that so well because you have a train that you can just kind of go over. But it definitely makes a huge difference not to be able to kind of go and work elsewhere.
Yeah. And when you were working on the last record with the Colorist Orchestra, that included reworkings of older material. And I read that when you were working with them on the new material, on When We Dance, you shared with each other that you should have written a whole record together. So do you think that that was the starting point for the new album, thinking we should do more of this original material together?
Yes, for sure. I mean, when we met, I was in a very funny place because after Tuca, I went through a little bit of a, you know, I was touring and I literally at one gig started thinking, oh, I hope, you know, my husband hasn't put my favorite sweater in the wash because I probably put it in the wrong basket and stuff like that. You know, it's going to fit my daughter or, you know, and I've always kind of thought like, wow, when I hit that place, it's time to stop, you know. And I was also really scared of that this would happen, because of course it happens in every work that you get really tired of it and you think about, I just want to go back to university or just do something else. But I just wasn't feeling that kind of, you know, when you go on stage and you kind of disappear into the movie of what you're singing, and it's such a amazing feeling, you know. And when that tour ended, I decided that I didn't want to kind of do anything anymore. And I was kind of throwing it out into the universe that I needed to, you know, get that sparkle again. It needed to be bubbling, but I didn't really know how to do that. And I just kind of retreated home. And a few months later, a guy from Berlin called me. I had a jazz festival, Mr. Studnitsky. And he said, hey, I really want to do your music with a quintet. In a, you know, different versions of your music. I've just kind of discovered it and I would like to do that. And I was like, great. And at the same time, I was just like, you know what? You just choose the songs, do whatever you like. I don't care what you do. And I'll just come and sing and we'll have an open rehearsal. And then I showed up like 3 months later, maybe. And there was just no quintet there. Instead, there was a sort of experimental jazz band. And I was like, where is the quintet? And he was like, oh, I did not have the time. So, and that made me just laugh really hard, you know, it really put me out of the box. And playing with a jazz band is completely different because, you know, it's a totally different ear. And I was a bit nervous and I was just like, can you just go easy on me? And we did that and it went really well. And then there was the other gig and then they just went off every time I forgot a word. They did a solo. And I was like, where am I? Where do I come in? So from that, I just got a real high again. And then I just kind of decided, because I didn't have the manager at the time, I was just not in the mood to be in any way in the business, you know. And so I just was getting these mails by myself and a friend was helping out with those mails, who was completely useless. And I kept getting these like, hey, I would like to play your music with you, but in this versions and this. And I started to do these kind of dogma rules. Like I stay at people's houses. They choose the songs. They can do whatever they like with them. And then I'll come and sing. And I did that for kind of 3 years almost. And I ended up in Cordoba with the gypsies. And I went to a living room gigs in Canada. And I played a gig where I had to talk the whole time because the guy couldn't really play the guitar. So there was a lot going on. So in the middle of that, the colorist orchestra called me before I would have probably been like, no, I don't want to do that. And this time I was like, yeah, just choose the songs, do whatever you like. Not realizing that theirs was a really intricate, really hard work. So they kept sending me music and I was like, no, I don't have to listen. I trust you. And then I showed up and I was like, oh, scheisse. Just like, what song are we starting? What is this? I couldn't recognize anything. And I had to kind of put headphones in. I realized how disrespectful I was and hadn't prepared and had to kind of learn the music overnight. And then we went on these five, it was only meant to be five gigs. And during that time, we kind of just fell in love with each other. And when we had to say goodbye, we were like, but it's really bad. It's a really terrible disaster if we say goodbye. So from that, we had lots of recordings. We just decided to, put it out mainly for us, just so that we can keep touring. So when we did this record, it was more like, can we write together? It would be really wrong if we couldn't, you know. So we've been trying to kind of pull apart slowly.
What I'm hearing from what you've just shared is that you are just a very spontaneous person and you allow yourself to just go wherever life takes you. And if people offer opportunities, you are quite open to them. And that has led you to this album and this point in your life.
It wasn't always like that. I was quite sort of square in my thing and private. And I really just needed... That's how I kind of thought, because I'm a solo artist. I always thought that's what people do. But then people just thought I was completely mad doing that. And there was a lot of this talk like, oh, but you've reached this place in your music and now you're just doing that. And aren't you afraid that that's kind of like, an embarrassment or you're lowering yourself? And that kind of talk I absolutely hate, because there is no such thing. Those are the places where you learn the most.
Absolutely.
And you meet people. And my husband was more like, are you crazy? You're going to stay at these people's houses and you have no idea who they are. It's going to be dangerous. And most people are fine. 99% of the world is just fine. And I'm sure like most of the time music doesn't trigger that kind of thing. I don't know. But it was just something that I had to do at that time to get back to where I am now.
Yeah. Yeah. You'd lived in the UK for over 15 years, and then your partner got a dream job in Iceland, so you had to once more reconfigure the geographical area that you called home. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, what to you is home in 2023?
It took a long time for me to make Iceland my home again, because I was actually in England for 20 years, which means that I was longer in England than I was in Iceland. And my identity in England was always the, yeah, I'm this Icelandic bird, you know. And then I come home and everything's totally alien to me. You know, to start living here was very, I don't get it. Everybody spoke English to me when I went to restaurants, and Icelandic to my husband because he looks like a Viking. And I was just like, wow, this is, I carry it with me being a foreigner suddenly. It was complicated. 3 years I was kind of miserable here, and I felt real shame about it because like, Iceland, woo! And then I was just like, wow, I'm really miserable. I can't stand living here. I need to get back home, you know, take me home. But my family was here and I had kids and we had been alone with a kid. And, you know, so that side was incredible. But it took time, even my family, it took them a year maybe to figure out that I was back. They just forgot to invite me to everything. And they're like, oh, you know, she's back, you know. So it was really complicated. And we are still kind of integrating, because we're still just listening to Radio 6, BBC 6 and BBC 4. And we are still trying to hack into BBC TV, the iPlayer, like, you know. It has taken a while. You know, we speak English at home, and it also shocked me that, you know, how English I had become, really. So it was all sorts of stuff. And I could connect with my dad better on that front, how he feels being a foreigner in Iceland and then moving to Italy and not belonging there anymore and having to come back here. It's complicated stuff, but really good. I'm really happy here now. But in the back of my mind, I'm always like, wouldn't it be nice to walk by the river in Chiswick, or, you know, go to the pub in Brighton, or, you know, pub lunches and stuff like that.
I imagine that Icelandic life is quite starkly different to the hullabaloo and to all of the madness of London living.
Yeah, very, very different. And I guess what I struggled with was material. You know, you're constantly in a train going somewhere, you travel so many hours, you listen to people's conversations, you're watching people, the flora of people, you know, it's slowly changing here. But when I grew up, we had no flora. It was just us. We all grew up with the same radio station, one TV station, you know. We were desperate in being different from each other, but we were all the same and we looked really the same, you know. So I really missed that cultural aspect as well. It was huge. It was really big to come here, and to you're much more isolated and you're more in your homes, and people here meet people, find it, they don't get new friends past 30. It's a very strange thing for them. And in England, your friends are family, you know, so you better get good at getting to know people.
It's so true.
And I can see it with foreigners, how much they struggle getting their own people here. And it's almost impossible.
With this being a Nordic music podcast, we ask our guests a bit about their corners of the world. What is your favourite part of Iceland?
Borgarfjörður Eystri. It's a tiny, 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 tinsy-winsy village in the east. And I went there in the summers to my grandmother. And it used to be a fishing village. And it has, you know, hardly any people live there. I think it's like 200 people maybe now. It was almost empty and just summer houses. But when I was a kid, people lived there. And there was boats there and life. And We started, my friend Heidar, he started a festival there. I did the first gig there and I was singing Fisherman's Woman there. And we started to work together and do a little festival. Well, that is a big festival now and people go to this town every year. We had Belle and Sebastian come, who were a bit shocked when they came there. They were like, where are we? And they weren't very happy in the beginning. And I just remember they went to Reykjavik and things were kind of not that friendly in the beginning. We went to there and playing football and then we were singing old Icelandic music in an old water tank with a candle. And slowly they were like, oh, this is all very strange. And then we went out on a boat and they were made them fish. And then we made dinner in the evening, you know, a fish bake or something, and told them that they had to fish their own dinner. There was a lot of Icelandic humor then. They were like, what? We have to fish for our own dinner. Oh, yeah. But this festival there has blossomed, and I try to go there whenever I can.
Do you think you might play the new record there at some point?
I hope so. I mean, we went to play our first gig here the other day, a whole gig at Harpa, and you know we are so many. We're like 15 on the road, so.
Wow.
It's a big battery to get us all over to play one gig, you know. I hope, I wish.
I want to talk about the new album. Listening to the album, two words came to my mind: rhythmic and rich, in terms of the arrangements and the production. The press release for it describes one of the best writing sessions of your and the Colorist Orchestra's lives in a farmhouse deep in the Icelandic countryside. Where was this, and what are your recollections about what made that session so special?
We decided to go to the farmhouse of a friend of mine, very remote, and we kind of just went there to see if, you know, to get the recordings going, because we'd gone a few times to my flat in Reykjavik. And it was kind of complicated because they weren't really songwriters, you know, they're arrangers and percussionists and playing instruments and stuff like that. So they were kind of bringing almost finished tracks. And it's fine if I have to, for doing top liners or something like that. But to be creative, it's not very interesting for me. It was all very beautiful, but I would have been like rah, 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 following their thing. And so when they came, I was just like, yeah, can we just take everything out except maybe the drum, or because there's no space for me. And so the real kind of journey in all of it was to find the common ground where we would write music from, basically. And I do a lot of improvisation first and sort of figuring out where to go from there. And I'm very opinionated as well and have ideas. And and so how we can work together. And when I decided that we just needed to go somewhere in peace, you know, so we went to Flateyri. It's very remote, and Ari's mom came with us, who's a beautiful character. We took our kids and wives, and so it was really amazing. And we were just kind of in the living room there and recording, and a lot of the ideas came there. When it was time to go home, we saw that there was a huge storm coming. And I was just like, yeah, well, I think we should just go now. And then you can at least get your flights, and we'll just step on it. And we literally stepped on it. We were just like flying down the road with the storm literally coming at us, and it only catching up with us when we're very close to Reykjavik. So, and on that way, we had one song we were thinking about, and then we were talking about the storm following us. And previously, I'd been in this farmhouse in Belgium working. And again, when we were doing When We Dance, I mean, it's a very stormy song, because when I arrive, there's this unbelievable electric storm. And it just seemed that every time I showed up, there was an electric storm, and kind of unnerving ones. And through COVID, when I finally get there to record, and at first I was just meant to be behind this glass for 5 days and not mingling with them, but then that changed. And again, there was a huge electric storm and it took the studio out for a few hours. And yeah, so we just thought we're constantly raising the storm. So that was what this record then ended up being called.
So that motif, that recurring motif, had to be the backbone of the record.
Yeah, because it became like a metaphor. Even COVID was like a storm metaphor.
You're listening to Melody AM.
The third song on the album and the new single is called Hilton, and it was incepted when you were having a bath in a hotel in Brighton. This is a real, real example of how rich and rhythmic the production on the album is. What can you tell me about the idea behind the song?
For me, I use it as an example when I talk at, like, if I have to talk in art school or whatever, or to people that are creating, because it was, I was going to a birthday or something in Brighton, and we hired, rented a room in the Hilton, and the bath was still like the old room, so it hadn't been kind of updated or something. So everything was kind of, and we had, there was a bath, and I get always very excited about having a bath. And usually I have a snorkel when I bath. Because I like just lying there and being able to breathe because I'm too small. I can't reach the other side. So I'm always like, you know, sliding. So I just go on my stomach. And this is where I'm kind of just going to, you know, I can travel anywhere when I'm in a bath. I go into the cenote in Mexico where I swam once that I love. And, you know, I just go into my own little world. And, but the tap of the of the bath was broken, so it's going like, and it just sounded like this kind of bebop. And I started kind of looking at it going, wow, it's actually just really making these rhythms, because it's never going kind of off, it keeps landing on the same rhythm again. And I recorded it, and then I just flew off one night, started seeing these tap dancers falling out of the tap, and they're like doing this dancing, and I was like, wow, this would be an amazing video. And then I met the guys and I showed this to them. And I said, I think we should replay it all, but with instruments. And of course, it's so complicated. And, you know, you couldn't find where it started, where it blew your mind, and it just became one soup. But we started to kind of work that song. But none of us knew that it would just become that. And there was many times where we went, oh, that's not going to work. This isn't working, this track. Let's just leave it, you know. But then we just kept kind of going. And when it finished, we were all kind of like, oh, really? That's mad. That's, you know, it was like one of those tracks that just completely surprised us. It just took charge somehow.
The video for the song has just been released. And I really loved your description of it as a broken image of one scene, and it presents that feeling also that we had, I guess, during the pandemic, where, you know, we were all on Zoom screens and we were in essence in the same scene, but it was again that broken image. What can you tell me about filming of that video and how it was to come up with that concept for it?
Well, Arish, who is one of the colorists, he is kind of a really great visual artist. He is kind of art itself almost. He is just like this kind of quiet clown, but not like, you know, but this kind of more like a kind of magical, just weaves in. He's very naughty. He's very, you know, he can create things, he can make things, he builds stuff, you know. We have no resources to make videos. So we only have ideas, and then how do we do them, you know, and how do we use nothing to create something? And I think that's where he comes in really well. And when you have ideas and stuff, he makes them into a reality. And with this video, it was, we were talking together on Zoom and like, how do we do something simple? And I was talking about, well, why don't we make something just in a super tight room? And we just kind of built walls and we're all just squished into this room. And then these dancers come in and it just keeps filling up with people and everybody's just kind of squashed. Because we had to try to find very, very simple, cheap ideas. But it ended up us being in the living room of Kobe, the other colorist guy. They had been doing this opera with children and the colorists were the band. And we got basically to just dance one of the parts from that opera, to just come into this space. And we had the flags that we're carrying around with us. We're trying to find space to hang them. It's the storm flags. Everybody had little things to do. And then I just had to stand there and be pretty and try to remember the lyrics.
And I mean, it's worth mentioning for those who haven't seen it, pretty is a very good accurate description, because that dress and those pink high heel shoes.
My pink gorilla dress.
Remarkable.
It's enough.
It's enough.
When we then saw the video, we were, well, I was like, well, maybe it's not, it's just too simple sort of thing. It's just this frame. And then, of course, Arish is like, boing, well, maybe we can just build this, you know, and then he comes and the video becomes something other, completely other. And that's, I guess, is a lot with this band, you know, it's about work. Making something really beautiful with very little resources and working constantly. My husband put it really well, because he works with engineers. And I was like, wow, and they're making legs, prosthetics and bionics. And I was like, wow, that's so artistic. And I mean, this is art, you know, you're designing this stuff. And he's like, no, it's not art. They don't consider themselves artists. And I was like, but why? Look at this, you know, this is amazing. And it's doing something good for the world. And it's always bettering itself. And, you know, it's thinking of new inventions. And, you know, and he's like, nope. And then he basically said, because engineers always work in no but. Somebody comes in and no, but they start thinking about the complications and go no, but no, 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 but artists always go, oh, yes. And, you know, there is always a motion. Everything goes into motion and you use what you can to create something out of nothing. So, yeah.
And in a way, that restraint of perhaps not having a budget to create a 40 million music video puts you in a different direction to think about out-of-the-box solutions and create something beautiful despite having little means. And I was thinking about the video for Mikos and how the simplicity of that is actually matched by how beautiful it is. And I think that the choreography and the movement that video has complements the music so beautifully. And again, I presume that didn't need a huge budget to be created.
No, just a lot of work. I kind of just swan in there because I come, you know, I don't come in there and build the stuff with him or anything. But when you have somebody like Arish and Kobe, you can, you know, we talk ideas through and we're very similar in what we like. We connect very much artistically. So it's great when you have ideas that you have somebody, a doer, you know, that just knows how to set it up and do it. But when we were doing Mikos, which is my favorite video, I lent it. We had to do two videos in a row. So first we started Mikos and then we did Hilton the next day. So it had to be really scheduled and really thought through. And, you know, the work of building everything and doing everything for like Arish and them was crazy, you know. And then all I had to do was kind of show up with my pretty bag. and I come to the airport and I basically go all the way to the hotel in Antwerp because I landed in Amsterdam and go to Belgium, to Antwerp. And then I'm like, do, come out of the train station. And I just go, that's not my bag. And I'm like, Stop the train running and knocking on it as if it's going to do anything. That's not my bag. And then I just went, oh my God, everything is in this bag. And there's no way you can find shoes and shirts and tights and all this in a few hours. And I went to the hotel and I was just like, what have I done? And so basically that whole night, I think I did 3 trips to the airport just trying to have my air tag on it, but it had just completely disappeared. And these people came to, you know, were so wonderful because I was just like, I have your bag. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. And they had to drive 2 hours to get the bag. And oh, it was a total disaster. A classic singer swanning in. Ruining the whole production. So yeah, that it ended really well, but oh my God, I think I almost lost all my hair with stress. Or just,
but you made it work.
Yeah, true.
So again, a storm, but something beautiful came out of it.
True.
This year is 20 years. I mean, I'm actually shocked hearing it out loud. It's 20 years since Kylie Minogue's Slow. And what's really remarkable about that is that hearing that song today, if it came out, if it was released in 2023, it would still sound fresh. It would still sound of its moment. And I think that's quite rare because with pop music particularly, a lot of it is very much of its time in terms of the sound. And you've spoken before about that writing session with Dan Carey. And if I remember correctly, I think the song itself came very quickly. But I wanted to ask you a bit about what you remember around the arrangement and the production that you and Dan created for that song, and what you think might have made it as timeless as it is still today.
I think it was just extremely spontaneous because we were doing a folk record at the time. We had gone just back to basics, but there is such a pop fanatic in me, you know. So when I got to do that song, we were just really excited, you know, but just to be able to do a pop song. And Dan had just rediscovered the guitar and we'd gone really lo-fi. So him getting back on the drum machine was just like, but the really funny thing about this, you know, because you're entering a totally different world. So you're talking to some A&R guys and they're like, yeah, can you bring up the bass? And you're like, no, why should we bring up the bass? It doesn't need, you know. And so we were having these kind of like, we didn't know it at the time, that you don't fight for your art, you know, when you're writing for somebody else. But anyway, we did. And we were very adamant that we would produce that song and we would be a part of that. But I think we had one of the biggest laughing fits in our lives when that record came out, because it came on the radio and we're like, it sounds very weird. And Dan realizes that we had recorded it in mono. So every time it goes on the radio, something happens. It's just like, whoop, and it just pinpoints you in. It's like, whoop, what's that? It just sounds very, very different. And I mean, you don't really record in mono, but yeah, that's what we did. And that's also why it sounds so amazing. It's unbelievable. I think we literally died of laughter. We were like, because it took him a while to figure it out. He was just like, what? What's going on? It was all just very fun. And she's very, you know, very wonderful. And she's a really good songwriter. I don't think she gets credit for her songwriting that much. But she's really fast. I'm like a snail. And then she's very professional, gets prepared. I mean, we couldn't be more opposite. It was really fun to just come. And then she brought this middle part into the song. And we're like, oh, so nice. Yes, let's do it. And it was good.
And of course, you actually also co-wrote another track on that album on Body Language, Someday. Was that from the same writing session?
Yeah. God, I forgot about that. Yeah, I think we had like three songs on there. I did Someday with the producer of the record. That was before any of that came up. I was just on a break and I met this guy called Ash and I was singing his demos basically. And we wrote this song and then that went on the B-sides or something like that. And then Dan and I wrote another one. I think so. I completely forgot about them. Yeah.
You mentioned Arich and Corbe earlier, and I was wondering, what to you sets the experience of working with them apart from the experience of working with, for example, Dan Carey and Simon Burt, who you'd collaborated with quite a lot before that?
That I still collaborate with. They are kind of my crew. but working with the Colorist Orchestra is like, it is the circus that I always wished to run away with when I was a kid. We are a circus without the tricks, you know, that way. We are a collective. Everyone is an artist in its own right. It's very easygoing. People are very much in the flow. We connect very much of just, you know, walking out the door and then we plop about and something always happens. We just go into this flow. We are just very the same minds a lot. Like we're, you know, we have had so many nights where after a show where, you know, it's the first time I'm not fired as a DJ. They love my DJing. Usually third song in and I'm like, doomf, elbowed out of the way. And we are always dancing, you know. There's a lot of laughter and silliness and fun, and we have had many nights where we don't know where to go after a show, and we put on good music, and suddenly we find ourselves dancing 5 hours down empty roads in Milano till we end up on some Moroccan place that opened the place for us, and that's more dancing. It's just kind of magical. Vibes, very gentle, not just in the sense of making music, but just in kind of living.
And there's a real cinematic feel to the output that you've created together. And I think that's really nicely reflected in the artwork as well. What can you tell me about the artwork and the concept behind it for the album?
We were all agreeing that it should be photographs. At first, I went to Belgium. We have lots of New Year's Eve postcards now and like weird, surreal tomato standing on a glass kind of pictures with yellow background. We were experimenting like, does this work? I don't know, with all sorts of items. I'm really into photography. I love photos. We were looking at photographs from Ari's dad that were beautiful. And we just kind of ended up exploring that. He was a really beautiful eye. He basically grew up in a toy shop. His father had a toy shop in Antwerp and built toys. And then he obviously was very creative, and his wife as well, and made all these beautiful pictures of people when he was traveling and around. And there's some so funny and beautiful. And then we kind of moved into the staged pictures that are still telling a story, like Alex Praeger and, you know, colors. And, you know, we are massive fans of inventors. So it's kind of rolled into that. We were doing photos with photo shoots, and we did a lot of experimenting, finding it. But somehow it just ended there.
And that artwork works so beautifully with the record, and the record itself, I think, is up there amongst your best work.
Thank you. I have to though give credit to, in the pandemic, I was just completely lost lyrically. And it's the first record I've ever written that I let people in on lyrics, because I'm very protective there. And I'm very specific of what I'm thinking. And I was walking with another artist friend of mine called Markéta Irglova, who moved to Iceland few years back, and she basically, we were taking these moan walks where I could just, you know, we could walk for 2 hours and moan, and I was doing a mega moan. It's like, oh, being really dramatic. I can't write a thing. This is awful. And she's like, well, you know, I have a studio and you can always just come to mine and we can. And I was like, oh, yeah, great. Let's do that. And so I had a partner in crime to talk on and to work with. And that was really fun. Amazing fun.
Sometimes you just need a change of dynamic, don't you?
Yes. Yeah. And also just not to, this is an open project, you know, you don't have to miser it. And I think, and for things to keep moving, because I really want to get my other record out too. I needed to do that. So it's great.
And is that one due to come out next year?
Yeah.
And would that be an Emiliana Torini and the Colorist Orchestra album? Would it be under a different name?
Yes, it is my record, but it's going to be, it's still, it's a big story. My friend in London, who I go to stay when I write, and her mother died, and we all knew her, all her friends. We would, she lived upstairs, and we would go up to her, hang out, and drink a cocktail and have a chat. And she was like this unbelievable, intelligent, funny, vivacious woman. And when she dies, I come to help her with a memorial and, you know, things like that. And she finds these huge wallets of letters. And it turns out that she had 9 proposals. These letters are from all these different men.
Wow.
At the time, I just kind of went like, do you want me to write a song in one of these letters? Like, yeah. So it was kind of like a healing thing, and we went in the studio and wrote this song, and then it just kept going, and we found that the man that was sort of the longest in her life, our longest friend, was a spy. We were kind of finding more and more out that she was as well. There are lots of very strange things opening up, and we've just gone on this journey that has just been incredible. You have this kind of biographical fiction that is turning into something that I've never been so excited about.
Wow.
I think ever, because it is really incredible. I can't really say a lot because, you know, it will show itself.
It sounds incredible.
Yeah, thank you.
But what a treat. So we have a new album this year, and then we also have an exciting new one to look forward to next year.
Yes.
Amazing. Emiliana Torini, thank you so much for joining me on this episode of Melody AM. What a pleasure speaking to you, and good luck with the new record and the tour.
Thank you so much. It's very lovely to talk to you.
The charismatic and talented Emiliana Torini there. And the small excerpt from the demo of Someday, which Emiliana sang on and was later recorded by Kylie Minogue, weirdly appeared online a few days before this episode was recorded. So I had to include a tiny bit of it. The Holy Grail remains an Emiliana Torini version of Slow, which I would love to hear someday. Emiliana Torini and the Colorist Orchestra's new album is called Racing the Storm, and I would also recommend you checking out the first 3 music videos they've released from the record. They're called Right Here, Mikos, and Hilton. Thank you so much for joining me for this second season premiere episode of Melody AM, and I hope you will join me next time. I will be speaking with a young singer-songwriter from Norway, whose music I discovered during the pandemic, and who has also kindly recorded a special acoustic version of one of my favourite tracks of theirs for the podcast. I'll be announcing more details about the next episode on Instagram very soon, so give us a follow at MelodyAMPod. Our new website also has a special page dedicated to today's guest. It's MelodyAM.com/Emiliana. And it has a playlist as well for you to check out. Melody AM is produced and presented by me, Daron Davidson, and our theme tune was written and performed by Minute Taker. Thanks for tuning in. Bye.